probably the biggest liability we talk about, because I was with a company, a large corporation, a really dear friend of mine, you know, recruited me for this job, and I was making more money every week than I ever had as an employee. Mm-hmm. And I walked away from that. And so it's somewhat sobering to hear this from you, because if I could go back to that time in my life, I would have told myself, David, stick with this, make a plan and work this plan before you exit. You know, make sure you have this parachute tested before you just jump out on your own. The only point I would contend with is that we're all going to survive. The question is, you know, what level of comfort can we maintain?
Yes.
And so, I mean, because I know you're, I have no doubt if there's anybody that could make something out of nothing or something with like a MacGyver, it would be you. So, you know, because all the stuff that you do, and there's so much depth to you, it's really inspiring. So let's sort of hit this corporate structure you talk about. So you basically set up what a pyramid is. And so the pyramid, you have a square at the base, and then or a quadrilateral geometric shape. Mm-hmm. And all these sides eventually meet together, unite at the top, at the top of the pyramid. And traditionally, the working class forms the largest populace of this pyramid.
Yes.
Right. And then goes up. And as you reduce, now what's interesting about this is that the skill set follows the availability of the populace there. So the skill set, more easily acquired skills are on the bottom.
Yes.
Take less skills to do these things, or less investment of time and training. But as you go higher up the pyramid, there's a scarcity of skill sets, right? There are specialties, mm-hmm. specializations. So you mentioned, you hit it pretty hard there when you talk about the wage. And one of the things you say with the CEOs, presidents and owners, this person makes an ungodly wage and probably doesn't have to worry too much about money. I would agree with that completely. But your use of the adjective ungodly points me to some very strong opinions about what a fair wage would be for a CEO, president, and you didn't go into that here.
Right.
Maybe that's another article.
Right.
Do you really think that, because I could argue that the person at the top of the skill set, at the top of the pyramid, has a very heavy burden that they're directing the pyramid below it.
Absolutely, yeah.
How would you even go about approaching what would be a fair wage?
At that point, I mean, given the corporate structure, if they have had the grit and the know-how and the skill set to get to that point, and in some cases the sheer lifespan to get to that point, then I think they should make an ungodly wage. Now, that's not to say I necessarily enjoy the pyramid structure, and I don't want to be a part of the pyramid structure.
That's the point I was getting at, but, exiting it.
Yeah, I don't want to be a part of it, but for the people who do want to be a part of it, who do see that as their dream, and they want to be at the point at the top of that pyramid, then good for them. Then good for them. If they are capable of getting there and successful in getting there, then they should make all the money in the world.
Yeah, and then that's what you start hitting on when you go in there and you say, you start from, it's a small handful of people, and then, you know, people are vying, and I love this because you use this repeatedly here. Their odds aren't very good considering there are far more of them than there are open positions, so scarcity of opportunity. Mm-hmm. So they fight and stand on each other's heads to prove that they are better than the rest of the, you know, executives, supervisors, directors, managers, whatever, and should be selected. But what's interesting, you used earlier the NASA comparison. Mm-hmm. I remember when I was on my mission in Utah, there was an elder there, one of their missionaries, ridiculously talented, music, brilliant, rugged, good looks, charismatic, athletic, and he said he was going to be an astronaut. And I remember telling him, like, I thought he was full of himself, first off. He spoke like four or five languages. Just, I felt like he grew up really privileged, and we just grew up on a different side of the world. What's interesting is I didn't know that you can do everything you want, but if you're too tall, or your body doesn't fit the pattern, you're not going to get in.
Yep.
You'll be placed somewhere else in a supportive role, but you'll be placed there. And that's what you mentioned. That's what you're pointing at with this here is that, and you just said it, if that's what you want, if you can get through that, but there's a passivity that, you know, that when you go into the MLM structure, mm-hmm. doesn't exist there.
That's absolutely right. And that's what, I'm not discouraging people from going into corporate America. What I'm trying to do is help them understand what they're getting themselves into. If you want to enter that structure and you want to be that guy that schmoozes and networks and climbs up the ladder to the top, and you want to put your future in somebody else's hands and hope that you get selected to get there and outlast the people around you, if that's what you want and that's your thing, then by all means chase that dream. I'm not trying to hold anybody back from their dream, but I just want people to understand and take a moment and think, is that my dream? And if it's not, then maybe I should chase something else. Maybe I should redefine what I say is success. And that's really the point of this article, is that, you know, these people that have been very successful in corporate America, well, good for them. Good for them. And I hope that's what they wanted to do. I hope that's what they wanted to accomplish in life. It's just not what I wanted to accomplish.
I love how you say in there that you realize you had spent more time at work than you had with your kids.
Yes.
All of us that go through that, some of us justify it by saying, well, look at the kind of life they live. Look at the kind of opportunities that my kids have. Like for myself, my wife has put our kids in swim lessons and music lessons and things that I never had an opportunity to do. A trampoline in the backyard. My mother bought our kids this huge 14, 15-foot trampoline. She wouldn't even let us jump on a little Jane Fonda 3-foot trampoline when we were growing up because she didn't want us to get hurt. And here she is buying our kids 2 trampolines. So it's great to have this opportunity here of consciousness. And what I love about your message, Terry, is there has to be a sense of nobility in, or a sense of mission, a sense of purpose that you've connected with. And I think it's apparent as I read this here, but I want to hear more about, where did you get this from? Is it something, this sense of compassion? Because to think about, you mentioned earlier the college students who are going to get a good job and they're, you know, going to have a great credit score and all sort of stuff. To me, you're reminding me of the crossing guard who's there. It's like, hey guys, you know, the light's there, traffic will stop, you can trust people, but I'm here to let you know, you need help. Mm-hmm. I want you to understand, like, why would you take your time to let other people know, like inform them, informed consent? It's like, hey guys, I want you to be aware of what you're getting yourself into. Why would that matter to you?
Man, so there's a real good question. There are different types of people in this world. I think the one thing that we all have in common is that we all seek a source of motivation. And there are people who seek motivation from people, and there are people who seek motivation from things. I'm not saying one is right and one is wrong. They just are what they are. Some people seek motivation from people, and some people seek motivation from things. I fall into the first category. I seek motivation from people. The motivation for me to act and to do things is having the understanding that in some way, shape, or form, the actions that I'm taking are having a positive impact on an individual's life. And like I said, there's nothing wrong with understanding that the actions that you're taking are generating income or you know, accomplishing some other material goal. There's a place for that. But granted that this blog is not currently making any income from me, maybe that'll change in the future, who knows. But right now, when you're dealing with information, I ask myself, if it takes me 1 hour to write an article, but if someone reads that article and it changes the course of their life, would that hour have been well spent? And to me, the answer every time is absolutely. And so if I can take an hour out of my day to help some college student who's trying to figure out what their hopes and dreams really are in this world, and has the entire world screaming at them that they need to get a good job because that makes them successful, and they see this article and they decide, well, maybe I need to take another look. If there's one person in the world that says that, then it was all worth it.
Right on. That's, oh man, that's great. I love it. There's so much I could say about that. But so you go there, you talk about these different contributors, a level of contribution, the availability of certain positions, and then the limitation of, I like how you say this here, this last sentence here in this paragraph, you say, so they fight back, stab, talking about the individual contributors, they fight back, stab, brown-nosed schmooze, and stand on each other's heads to prove that they are better than the rest of the nameless employees and should be noticed enough to be placed in the pool of potential ladder climbers, hoping that someday, somehow, someone else, someone else with some pull in the company will notice them and decide that they should get to have a future. So where do I sign up?
Exactly.
Right?
And that's really, that right there embodies the point of the article. And I think you can relate to this because we both serve church missions. When you're in the mission field and you've been out for almost 2 years, you've been acting as a missionary, you've been doing missionary work, you've been trained on all these things for 24 months, you know what you're doing.
Essentially, we're finding ways to serve people.
Right. But you're good at it.
Yeah.
You've become proficient at it. And when new guys come in, you know, these are 19-year-olds, you know, fresh out of high school. They're coming in trying, they're saying, yay, I'm going to be a missionary. And they don't have a clue what they're doing. They're standing exactly where you were standing 2 years before, stars in their eyes, you know, not really understanding how to talk to people. People skills could be a lot better. They got all the heart in the world, but they just don't really know what they're doing. And you, as the experienced missionary, are responsible for taking one of them under your wing and training them to do what you do, to pick up the skills that you have picked up. And the only way that you succeed in that role is by helping them succeed in their role. Now let me ask you something. When you were a missionary, the greatest success, I know for me, the greatest success that I ever saw was when we were all working together to help each other succeed, and we all succeeded together. We elevated each other because we were trying to elevate the other person. And in the end, the work of sharing, in this case, the gospel, but you can translate that into terms of business, but in terms of sharing the gospel, more was done, more was accomplished, more people's lives were changed when we were all trying to help each other. Now transition that to corporate America, the structure that we have, where you go in as an underling. You're not even on the corporate ladder at first, but you work your tail off long hours to try to get noticed, to try to beat the other people out so that somebody who's more experienced, who has a different skill set, who has more time in the company, can notice you and say, hey, out of all you little underlings, I like that one. And I think that in 30 years, he could be a potentially a good manager. And so I'm gonna kind of latch on to him and hope that it pans out. And I'm not really gonna worry about the other people.
But there's a certain level that some of the pattern that we see with that, and when we worked in those places, is that individual has to be, in other words, they can't really threaten the well-being, like you mentioned the article about that individual who's willing to take a chance and give this person an opportunity, right?
Yeah.
Help them reach the next level, whatever kind of corporate jargon we want to use. But understand there's a glass ceiling there. And as long as you stay in your place and you feed me the good ideas and make me look good, then I'll do what I can for you.
Yes. Until you're not really of use to me anymore. And so you ask yourself, well, are you ever going to make more money than your boss? Now we're talking business. The answer is, well, no. There's a reason he's your boss. He's going to make more money than you. So how do you make more money than him? Well, you got to become the boss. Okay. Well, how do you become the boss? Well, there's a few ways to do that. Number one, you literally have to outlive him. So he like dies and then there's an opening. So you become the boss. Or you outlast him. So he retires at 70 years old and maybe by this point you're 55 years old and you become the boss. Or he gets fired because he wasn't a very good boss. And then you're sitting there scratching your head saying, well, I got trained by this guy, so am I going to be a very good boss? Because I received training under the mentorship of somebody who just got fired. And so you're stuck in all these kind of dead-end positions.
But there's one you missed.
Okay.
If you slit his throat, if you outperform him and bump him off.
And that would be, I guess I would consider a demotion kind of on the along the same lines as being fired.
Yeah.
Because he is not performing, therefore he's let go from his position. And so in all of those, you're dealing with a mindset of there's no collaboration, there's no edification of each other, there's no collective elevation. It's a zero-sum game where if you're there, I'm not, and if I'm there, you're not. And we can't share the position together, and we can't rise together. And there will always, in order for someone to rise, there have to be 10 people who fall. That's the way it works. That's the way the pyramid works. That's the way corporate America works. There will always be exponentially more people that fall for every one person who rises. And again, if you understand that and you're cool with that, fine. But I'm not.
Yeah. Even without saying it, you're not really fine, because by getting this information about out there, you want others to feel that level of discomfort and challenge the thinking. I mean, that's what I love about, I'm really grateful that you started this blog, because I mean, it's fuel for me. I appreciate it. It gets me thinking about things I hadn't thought about and things in different ways, but it keeps me thinking. I mean, one of the biggest challenges, I think it's interesting that you said you have coworkers when you guys go to the food court and you talk about, it sounds like there's recurring themes here. You guys are pretty aware of what's going on. And so you're all sort of scheming and thinking, okay, well, what's our escape plan? I think about all these movies in the past, you know, Escape from Alcatraz. Mm-hmm. I think you say that in the article, right? Mm-hmm. There you go.
Dig out with my spoon.
With your spoon, right?
Yep.
I thought of Monty Python when I see, but before we grab our pitchforks and start screaming pyramid, and I'm thinking about the witch scene.
Yes.
Right? So now you start talking about the metaphor you use is the redheaded stepchild. Where did that come from? Is that from a novel or some book in history that?
You know, that's something that I just picked up in American jargon. I don't know what the origin is, but yeah, it's a commonly used phrase from.
Yeah, I've heard it for a long time. I just thought you might have the answer for that offhand.
I don't.
Because I mean, there's some great looking redheaded girls that I've seen in my life, and I'm like, well, why would anybody want to? Wendy's is a perfect example. The chocolate frosty, I love that thing. Good old Dave Thomas. Okay. And I love how you anticipated where our mind is going to go with this, because they say, let's take a look at a totally different type of business. And I can't help but laugh when I think as I read that, I'm like, dude, what a great segue into what he's going to pitch. And then you say, you know, and just as a forward, this is not, capital not, a sales pitch to anyone. And so we're going to go in and start talking about MLM. Now, when were you first introduced to MLMs?
Oh, gosh. I've been introduced to MLMs countless times in my life.
When was the first time that somebody either came to you to recruit you or that you even found out such things existed?
21.
Right after your mission?
Yes.
Me too.
Well, I have to say before that, because we can talk about it more once we've examined the MLM structure, but I would have to say that I had already been a part of an MLM for 2 years, just not a financial MLM.
Okay, I see what you're saying, yeah.
But I just didn't know it.
Yeah.
Because I had been so indoctrinated with the idea that the three letters MLM were bad, they were scary, they were Ponzi schemes, they were pyramids, they were the assault rifle equivalent of the business world.
Yeah.
Not because they were anything different, just because they had a scary name, you know?